Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With your host, Frank Thompson.
Hello and welcome to episode 57 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson. I'm a people who needs people, which theoretically makes me the luckiest people in the world. I've got a great show for you today or tonight. Matthew Kennedy, author of a new book called Roadshow, The Fall of Film Musicals in the 1960s. This is a great book, right up my alley. But Matthew's written several books that are right up my alley, biographies of Joan Blondell, Marie Dressler, and the director Edmund Goulding, and we talk about all of that. Now, this episode is late getting up because of the just how much we talked about, I guess. Matt and I, we get along like a house of fire when we start talking movies, and it's great fun for me, and we just went on and on and on. So the podcast ended up being a solid 2 hours long and would not load. I didn't realize for the longest time that it was simply the length of the thing that wasn't loading because my uploader wouldn't give me any advice. It would just not do it. So I sent in the file to James Hutchins, my brilliant webmaster, and he said, it's just too long. So what I've done is split it into two parts. But unlike what I normally do when I do it in two parts, which is post one this week and one next week, I'm going to post them both today. Theoretically, if I had done this when I should have, part one would have been last week and part two this week. So I'm going to do them both, and you can listen to them at your leisure. I'm not pushing you to listen to both of them today. That would be crazy. That would be pushy on my part. So I'm not going to do that. But I hope that you will want to listen to the whole thing because it's a really interesting interview, and Matt knows his stuff. During this talk, I came to regret how few times we've spent together. We've only been in the same room together, as far as I know, one time. And we talk about that in the interview. But I enjoy talking to him so much, I just wish we could do it much more often. So I wouldn't be surprised if he showed up on this podcast again one of these days. Maybe we'll wait for his next book, and maybe we won't. Maybe we'll just get back together and start talking movies again. That would be okay by me. This is a month of anniversaries. I don't know if you are like me in this respect, and I hope if you are, that it's the only respect in which you're like me, because I wouldn't wish that on anybody. But I love locations, and there's something about an anniversary of something that lends a special edge to going to a location where it was made. On January 10th, my friends Stan Taffel and Carl Thiede, both formidable film historians, and I went down to Venice, California, on the date that Charlie Chaplin first appeared on film in his tramp costume in a film called Kid Auto Races in Venice. If you've never seen it, I highly recommend that you do, because it's fun. It's kind of a docu-comedy, because they took their cameras down to film an actual race, kind of like a soapbox derby race, and Chaplin puts on his tramp clothes for the first time and just plays a guy wandering in and out of the scenes, just trying to get in front of the cameras. He plays this tramp who sees movie cameras and thinks that it would be great for him to show his star power. So the entire movie is just pretty much him trying to sneak in front of the camera and people throwing him away from the camera. But it's funny. And so Stan and Carl and I went there and visited the sites, and even with John Bengtson's incredible book on Chaplin's locations, we still got mighty confused, but we found a couple of houses that were in the backgrounds of the shots. Well, we found basically that the locations are completely different than they used to be. There are streets now where there were no streets. There was a lagoon and an amusement park in Chaplin's day, and those are all gone now. The lagoon is a mere traffic circle. But anyway, it was great fun, and we actually took down the DVD, put a portable DVD player on the top of Stan's car, and stood there on the route of the race and watched the film 100 years to the day after it was made. So that was great fun. More recently, we went to the Senate Studios, which, oddly enough, are still standing. It's now a huge storage unit, but you can still, if you look at a picture of the Senate stage or the Senate studio back in 1914, you'll see that the building is unchanged. Very nice people who worked there who let us go inside and took us up to the top floor. Obviously, the inside of that studio is very different because of the storage units. But once you get up on the top floor and you can see the rafters, it's all vestiges of the Senate days. And it's really amazing how many there are stenciled numbers on the rafters and steel girders and chains and pulleys and all sorts of equipment for hauling sets and everything around, and really something to be able to find just that little bit of 100 years ago still there. Chaplin apparently made his first film appearance, not as the tramp, but as Chaplin, you know, just as a character, on that location. And it was first shown on February 2nd, 1914. And so that was the day we got out there. We're not quite sure what day it was shot. So we decided to go on the day that it was released. The place where Chaplin made his first appearance, as far as we know, is now a drive-thru to Jack in the Box. So we stood there and paid our homage, and then we went inside and got a snack. What would you do? The same thing, I bet. And also, of course, this month is a big month for me because it marks the 75th anniversary of the production of Beaugeste. I don't know how many of you are on my Facebook page or my Facebook friends, but I hope that you will all come and join up. And I'm posting a bunch of stills and behind the scenes and production shots from Beaugeste, trying to do them day and date on the time in which they occurred. So then that will continue through March for the actual production of that film. And then I'll come in sporadically later as things come up. And then when it finally premieres, I'll have shots from the premiere and that sort of thing. I've just been having a lot of fun with anniversaries. And today, February 9th, 2014, is a huge anniversary in my life, which is the 50th anniversary of the first time the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. There's a lot of brouhaha about it, and like most things like this, I took that thing so personally that it still kind of surprises me that other people know about it. But in fact, it was at the time, I think, the most watched television show in the history of television. So some 70-odd million people were watching. So I guess I'm not quite as unique as I thought I was. But it was a big, big, huge event for me, and I dare even say life-changing event. It was, it's incalculable how much impact that and the ensuing career of the Beatles had on my life. So I want to pay homage to them now, and I will be watching the DVD of that episode, which I'm glad to say they released in its entirety, each episode in its entirety, with commercials and everything. So I can sit down for the full hour and recreate this memory to whatever extent it is a memory. I'm very vague about the original viewing, but I will be there this evening to watch it all again. And I will love it just as much as I did then, and as much as I've loved it every time I've watched it. I want to make one correction about the interview before we get started. You know, I do these things kind of off the cuff. I try to be well-versed in what my guest has done, but sometimes the conversation just goes where it goes, and so there's no way to prepare for everything. For whatever reason, I got to talking about Roland Brown, the director Roland Brown, and also screenwriter, that I consider Roland Brown the single greatest director ever lived. And the reason is, he only made 3 films, and they're all great. And, of course, Matt then said, well, what are the 3 films? And I could only remember the names of 2 of them, which was made me a little bit sheepish at the moment, because if I brought something up and got very specific about it, I should know what I'm talking about. And I do, but I just forgot. It just slipped my mind. The 3 movies are, for your for your edification, the one I couldn't remember was Quick Millions, 1931, then Hell's Highway, 1932, and Blood Money, 1933. They almost never show up on television of any kind. I don't think any of them is available on DVD, at least legally. But if you ever get a chance to see any of them, and especially Blood Money, which is one of the pre-codest of pre-code movies you could even imagine, I highly recommend them. It was certainly a complete tangent for this podcast, and yet I went there. I take tangents. What can I say? So this is part 1 of my talk with Matt Kennedy, and befitting a good road show, there will be an intermission. So I hope that you will go right to part two when this is done, which will be following shortly. So I'll see you on the other side. Let's go back to when you and I first met, which was when you were working on your book on Marie Dressler, and we had dinner with Karen Morley. First of all, I don't recall how you and I even knew each other and how you knew that I knew Karen Morley.
I don't either, and I wonder if the original reference might have been Jim Parrish, who has been a great mentor and who seems to know everybody and is great for referrals and whatnot. It might have been Jim Parrish.
He doesn't know me,
nor I him. Well, that detail has been lost to time. I might have to, maybe I could look up some ancient files or something.
It has to have been close to 20 years ago.
It was, I want to say maybe 1996 or 97. So okay. 18, 17.
Yeah.
When I was working on the biography of Marie Dressler, which was my first book. Yeah. And yes, and
I was a teenage author at the time.
Yeah, so. Right. I was like four. Yeah. But somebody told me that you knew Karen Morley. I got very excited by that news because I was hoping to interview whoever might be surviving who knew Marie Dressler at that point. And the fact that she was also a cast member of Dinner at Eight was, I think at that point, the sole surviving cast member.
I believe so.
Was a singular thrill. So, yeah, we went out to the deli on Ventura Boulevard.
Yeah. Jerry's Deli.
Jerry's Deli.
Where Andy Kaufman used to work when he was.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I remember, I will never forget, Karen Morley's dinner. This was a woman in her 80s at this point, and she ordered a pastrami sandwich on rye, a Coke, and cheesecake for dessert. I thought, okay, that's the diet for longevity.
That was our Karen, yeah.
Yes.
We were always so appalled, because every time we'd go to her house for dinner, she would make a salad, and then she would dump about a half a pound of salt on it.
Wow.
And I thought, you don't salt salad. Stop doing this. It was a horrible thing.
Well, how did you know her and have a forge a friendship?
I met her through Julie Barton, who was the widow of Charlie Barton, who was the director of 11 Abbott Costellos and, you know, every episode of Amos and Andy and all these Disney things, Toby Tyler and Shaggy Dog. And Charlie had been assistant director to Wellman, and I had interviewed him when I was doing my book, when I first started working on the book. And he's actually in Beau Geste. He and Broderick Crawford are the two buddies, the two American buddies in Beau Geste. And so I just kept in touch with Julie. Who is, by the way, she was a singer and a ghost singer, but you see her in Preston Sturges' Hail the Conquering Hero at the beginning of the film when he's sitting in the bar and the three people are singing. That's Julie.
Okay.
Home to the Arms of Mother, they're singing.
Well, I remember.
But she had been blacklisted, and so there was this whole network of people who were friends of hers. And I thought Karen Morley was dead. Because I'd never heard from her for years.
She pretty much disappeared from the scene for a very long time.
And then Julie mentioned her in passing one time that she knew her. I said, I got to meet her. So it turned out we became very good friends. And then when Claire and I were married, we just celebrated our 20th wedding anniversary. And we only had two witnesses, which were my mother and Karen.
Oh, wow.
So
I remember you were very thoughtful in telling me what to talk about and what not to talk about before we had dinner. And you had said that Karen is not really one to get nostalgic and that I should not simply launch into questions about the days at MGM and so forth, but that I maybe could try to finesse a few questions as dinner progresses and so forth. And so I don't think I did it in the most diplomatic way, but it was fairly late in dinner when I brought up the name L.B. Mayer. It was the first movie reference, I think, of the entire evening. We'd otherwise managed to talk about everything else. And she looks up, she gives me, you know, she shoots daggers with her eyes straight at me, and she says, "Please, I'm eating." And that's all I got from her feelings about I'll Be Mayor. Maybe that's all I needed to get.
Yeah. You know,
it pretty much summed everything up. But she did, the one thing I remember her saying that was actually useful to me for the book was that she said, and she completely volunteered this information. She knew, I mean, she was a very smart woman, and I think she knew that, well, we know why this, you know, why Frank has arranged this dinner, this guy's writing this book, and he really would like a nugget or two from me.
Sure.
And even though she didn't, again, want it to be sort of formally presented, and she said, completely unsolicited at one point, she said, "Marie said to me, save your money." And so this is a much older actress talking to a much younger actress offering this sage advice, and which was actually quite a pertinent thing for Karen to share with me because Marie had lost her fortune more than once in her lifetime.
As did Karen.
You go.
Yeah. Yeah, at that time when you met her and when we knew her, she was living in a tiny apartment in North Hollywood and had enough to get by. I mean, she could buy groceries, but that was about it. So,
did she have a career after being blacklisted? Did she do stage or?
She did stage. She ran for lieutenant governor of New York and failed. And not much, you know. I think Joseph Losey's M might be the last film she was in, and that was in the '50s. Am I right? Fifties. I'm not an encyclopedia, folks.
Yeah.
But I think, but she has a very small part of the beginning of that as the mother of the first victim of the film. And, that was about it.
Wow.
But we, because of her, Claire and I moved out to California and all the people we knew virtually were old commies. It's like, it's everybody, all of her friends. And so we just had this huge network of friends who were in their 70s and 80s and were old blacklisted commies. And a lot of really interesting people.
Frank, that sounds like a book.
They're all dead now, I think.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think Phil Stern is about the only one, the photographer, who's about.
I know Lee Grant was blacklisted. And she.
Yeah, she was.
She's with us.
But, yeah, Karen was, you know, understandably bitter about that. And so so she didn't have a lot of rosy memories of Hollywood, but I figured she would know something about Marie Dressler. Now, did you ever get to talk to her again, or was that your one shot?
That was it. Yeah, we didn't talk again.
Yeah, that's too bad. Not that you would have gotten much more from her. I took her to CineCon one year where they showed Arsène Lupin, and then she was going to do a Q&A afterwards with me. And so I went up and sat. We went up to this table and we sat there in front of the crowd, and I asked her a genial opening question, which she completely ignored. She pulled out a sheath of papers and started reading these memories that she had jotted down. And when she was finished, and I didn't ask her a single thing.
Wow.
And she didn't take a single question from the audience. And that was that. But she did tell one story that I've always remembered. And I have the papers, by the way, that she just gave me that sheath of papers, so I have those. But she was on the set with Garbo, and there was an aquarium on the table, a small aquarium with a goldfish in it, and there was a big Klieg light right over the aquarium. And Karen said that she went to somebody and said, "That's going to kill that goldfish."
Yeah.
And across the room, she heard Garbo said, "Oh, she worries for the fishes."
You know, just love little things like that because, you know, they're otherwise going to be lost forever.
Sure.
And it's just a little moment of
Well, but I guess the question to bring this slightly back on track is, why in the world Marie Dressler? I mean, she's certainly a fascinating person, but how in the world did that become a subject of a book for you?
Well, yeah, and my first, too, which was, you know, she was not well known after her, you know, all these years after her
sure.
death, even though she was this star of the highest magnitude in the early 30s. But when I was a kid, I would watch films on TV. It was before VCR was available and DVDs and so forth, and I, you know, it's people of a certain age remember, you know, the only way to see old movies would have been on TV chopped up with commercials. And I saw Dinner at Eight that way. And I will just never forget this fantastically entertaining older actress. And my mother, who was a great fan of film and saw everything in the 1930s when she was a little girl, said, oh, that's Marie Dressler. She was this really popular actress that, you know, was this sort of wonderful mother figure during the early depression and whatnot. And I just never forgot this fascinating, incredibly entertaining woman. And I think I saw Dinner at Eight, at a repertory house and was sort of reacquainted with her much later and then got the idea of, gee, I've been writing these film reviews and I really like doing that. Do I dare write a book? And somehow those two things came together. Maybe I should try writing a book. Nobody's ever written a biography of Marie Dressler. Let's see if I could dare do this. And then I just started doing some research and in her life and found it even doubly fascinating. You know, I started at the very end, which was Dinner at Eight, but then learned that she had this fantastic career in vaudeville and was the star of Tilly's Punctured Romance, which doesn't endure as a great film, but is historically extremely sure. significant as the first feature-length comedy, and right on the brink of Chaplin, you know, perfecting the tramp and so forth. So, Dressler just got more and more interesting to me. And she worked with great stage names like Lillian Russell and Weber and Fields. And
yeah.
So I delved into theater history, and it was just fantastic. I loved writing that book.
Yeah, I mean, that I completely understand how fascinating that would be. And I completely understand writing a book about somebody that nobody's ever heard of.
Cause, yeah.
Because I do it all the time.
Yeah. But, well, I think you and I are similar that way. I love looking for stuff that, you know, in film history that's now obscure but was really important in its day. And
sure.
It feels like that's discovery on my part as well, as I hope readers alongside
yeah.
me.
Dressler is interesting to me because in Tilly's Punctured Romance, she's already Marie Dressler. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there's no doubt about it. And she doesn't seem to physically change that much for the rest of her life. I mean,
it's true.
She still lives 20 more years.
It's
but
true.
She was already pretty much the same person as Dinner at Eight. Yeah.
This huge, huge comic who did amazing things with her body.
Yeah.
I think that is maybe the one difference. I agree. I mean, physically, visually, she doesn't look to have changed between that and to Dinner at Eight. I think she's a little more agile in
sure.
Tilly's Punctured Romance.
Of course.
And so the value of that document is getting some idea of how her physicality on stage in her earlier career, which according to reviews was just mind-boggling, that this woman was like doing backflips and crazy stuff all over the stage, which you just simply don't expect given her stature.
Sure.
And that, you know, it had tremendous impact on the audience.
Every once in a while you'll find someone of a certain size
mm-hmm.
who is just incredibly agile.
Yeah.
Roscoe Arbuckle is a great
mm-hmm.
example.
Mm-hmm.
He's like an athlete, like a gymnast.
So,
and it's just amazing. You know?
Which makes me think, wouldn't it have been interesting to see the two of them together?
Oh, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And they could have worked together, but mm-hmm. Too bad.
Yeah. Our loss.
Yeah. Now, other than Karen, did you meet anybody else who knew Dressler?
Yes. And this is why, actually, one reason I'm glad I wrote that book when I did, because there were people who knew her that are all since gone. But I felt a real sense of urgency there.
Sure.
So I talked briefly to Jackie Cooper.
Ah.
And Joseph Newman, the director, who was the assistant director of Men and Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to Dressler's last nurse, Anita Page.
Oh, yeah.
And I think I'm missing a couple of other folks. But yes, there were a handful of people I could still talk to.
Can I interject?
Joan Marsh, actually. Oh, also, great. Yeah.
I was going to say I can interject another Karen quick story, which is I once asked her why she decided to come to movies. She said, Anita Page.
Really?
I said, why? She said, I figured if she could do it, anybody could.
Not having known Karen well, only that one time, that sounds very much in character. She was not reserved in her
not at all
opinions. Yes.
Were you able to see all of Dressler's films? How many are not with us anymore?
I was able to see all that are known to survive. Now, fortunately, her entire sound output is available.
Sure.
But this is also, it's a little history lesson within a history lesson, is that I wrote that book in the late 90s, and it was actually before, I did not have Turner Classic Movies. Turner started in the early 90s, I believe.
TNT, which was the precursor to TCM, started in about 1990, 89 or 90.
It was, but I mean, writing this book was before, you know, Warner Brothers archives on demand and, you know, various, the ready availability of a lot of these films. So I actually came down to Los Angeles to, and actually went, you know, on a Moviola, saw stuff at the UCLA archives.
Sure.
And I actually went to Washington to go to the Library of Congress to see the surviving 8 minutes of Tilly's Tomato Surprise. And, you know, that is really still the only place you can see that footage. But that was actually very fun for me. I mean, it was like detective work and seeing every spare second.
That's real research.
Possibly could.
Yeah.
It is. And you know, you have to be a special kind of nerd to love that.
You do.
And I do. And I know you do too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote my first couple of books, not pre-video. I mean, there was already video cassette, but you still had to rely on what was available, which was not all that much.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the case of Marie, there was, I remember distinctly, when I went to look to see all of her films, there were only four available commercially. And so all the others I had to see through archives and other means. Yeah.
What did you learn about Marie that surprised you? I mean, was she, she did really good dramatic work as well. Sometimes, I mean, there's a lot more of a theatrical edge to her dramatic work than to her comedic work, I think. But, I mean, she seems to hit it a little harder.
Yeah, that's a good observation. I wonder if that's also because of how we look at comedy and drama today.
Sure.
You know, that broad comedy is, you know, never goes out of style, perhaps. And that her brand of drama is indeed much more heavy-hitting than you might expect today, or seemingly melodramatic. I mean, one of the things about her that always strikes me whenever I look at her films again is how wildly she uses her face.
Yeah.
I mean, these expressions that to a modern audience might look seriously put on, and that most directors would say, cut. Marie, could you tone that down just a little? Could you not make quite so many rubberized expressions and whatnot? I find it kind of wonderful. I mean, as a style that doesn't really have any descendants that I can tell in modern acting, but a kind of commitment to, I don't know, expressing large emotions. It's almost, her face is almost operatic.
Yeah. Well, it harkens back to something we were talking about before we started rolling, and that is you can't overestimate the influence of theatrical training, especially on people in early films.
Yes.
And when I think of her and her facial gesticulations, I think that is born for the stage. I mean, that is exactly perfect for the stage, because the person in the back row is going to see everything on her face. And that's great stage acting.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't give that up just because you go into a different medium, although people learned how to tone it back. But that's still always there.
Yeah.
For those people. And especially for her.
Well, and it feels like she kind of got away with it where others might not.
Yeah.
Or that most stage-trained actors, in, as you said, it's, you know, abandon that for the screen. There are moments in Marie's screen career, into the talkies, where she actually is, at least by Marie standards, fairly subtle with her face and her body and her voice. And you know, unfortunately, having, you know, since she died in 1934, her screen career was not very long in the talkies, but it's sort of, I imagine that subtlety or that calibration, if you will, to the camera would have only been matured and gotten more powerful had she had a longer film career.
Yeah.
There's some moments in Min and Bill where, I mean, she's over, you know, she emotes very largely through most of it, but there are times where her face is magnificently subtle.
Yeah.
Especially at the end. And you can sort of imagine what might have been had she been able to go on into the, you know, more into the 30s.
Yeah. But what, when she used that for comedy, it was magnificent, always.
Yes.
And I always think of her final scene. Of course, everybody thinks of this scene in Dinner at Eight, when she's talking with Harlow about the book. And as soon as Harlow says, I was reading a book the other day, and Dressler does this incredible body roll. It just, she stops, but it goes,
she stops, but it doesn't fully stop.
Yeah. It's like
the
boing.
Feet stop, but the body doesn't or something. Yeah.
It's this great
fantastic
comic take and completely unnatural in that way, but because it's a comic take, it's incredibly great.
Yes.
And of course the whole scene is great. And it's also, that to me is, a class on what comedy acting was and what it was about to be.
Yes.
Because Harlow, who was a brilliant comedian as well, but she's playing it, I mean, her character is a bit broad because it's this brash bimbo, but she's still playing it with complete innocence and not overstating anything while Dressler is this huge thing, and not physically I'm talking, but just this huge presence.
Yeah. Well, and Harlow was quoted as saying that she just sort of surrendered that moment to Dressler. Yeah. And in fact, you know, a young inexperienced actor going up against someone at that point of the fame and belovedness of Dressler, I could fully, you know, imagine doing that. That maybe Harlow was even a little intimidated by her, but that moment works so well because they both are simply perfection.
Yeah.
You know, in inhabiting those two roles and those two very sort of contrasting visions of womanhood, if you will.
Yeah.
It's one of film's great moments, and I'm just glad it's there.
Now, Dressler, as you said, was incredibly popular in the early 30s. I mean, it's unbelievable how popular she was.
Yeah.
But did she die rich, or did...
She died well off, yeah. She did not make the kind of weekly salary Garbo did, or Shearer, or some of the others at MGM at the time, that you might expect, given that... But she did just... She was fine at the end of her life. She was well off, and lived in a lovely home in Beverly Hills, and so forth. This is another point. I'm glad you brought that up, because it was the... Maybe another point of fascination for me with her was that she was the number one box office when you polled movie exhibitors in 1931 and 1930, or is it 32 and 33, she was polled as the most popular star in America. And I was absolutely fascinated by that. How did this woman who does not possess this, what you expect as the typical trappings of stardom, how did she come to be so incredibly popular? And I thought, this is a great story, you know, the most unlikely star in the world, and here she is. But, you know, as under contract to MGM and Mayer, she was well compensated. So yes, financially she died, wealthy enough. And certainly, you know, extremely lavish given the realities of the Depression.
She was only in her 70s when she died, right?
She was actually only in her 60s.
Was she?
She was 65 when she died.
Wow.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. So.
And she actually, you know, we could look at her today and say, oh, she looks like pretty elderly dowager.
Yeah.
But that's another point. You know, we were talking earlier about how we love old movies because, you know, the time capsule and how
sure.
they preserve a particular moment. And plastic surgery, I learn, was perfected or begun after World War II, or excuse me, after World War I, to treat people who'd been disfigured yeah. in the war. And so plastic surgery and facelifts were actually happening in the early 30s. But, you know, Dressler knew that her fame and her her popularity was based on having complete access to her highly expressive face.
Sure.
And she used to make fun of her jowls and her bags and so forth. And so she, by today's standards, you might look at her in Dinner at Eight and say, oh, she's, you know, up there. But she was actually, you know, barely a senior citizen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very strange. It's funny to me when I compare popular stars of today to popular stars of then, to me what is so immediately obvious is that those people had faces that were easy to caricature.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas very few stars of today have those really pronounced features.
Yeah.
Same with voices. Everybody can do Cagney. Everybody can do Edward G. Robinson. Everybody can do Cary Grant. Who today can you do? You
know,
there's almost, it's almost like that incredible distinctiveness has been bred out of the mm-hmm. business in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that is, but it's...
Well, is there sort of maybe a somewhat overly simplistic way of saying that, you know, there are personality stars and there are actor stars, right?
Yeah.
And maybe the greater emphasis today is on actor stars, where the value or the prestige comes in being able to lose yourself in a particular role.
Yeah.
I'm going to wear a new accent, wear a new wig, wear a, you know, a new persona. And I want to be a chameleon, right? And as you say, I mean, some of the greatest stars of the past, you know, Cary Grant was a great actor. And I mean, when I see Cary Grant, I think he's a fantastic actor. I mean, he has one
sure.
of the most...
I think he's one of the best there ever was.
Absolutely. I mean, the intuitiveness and the seeming ease that he has in front of yeah. the camera and the affinity he has for the camera is just phenomenal to me.
Yeah.
And I never lose sight of the fact that I'm watching Cary Grant.
Sure.
And it's just this parallel experience of great acting and great personality wrapped into one. And I think you're right. Today, we don't necessarily even know what personality that star has, right?
Yeah.
We see the acting, but we don't see
yeah.
the person that is animating the acting.
Yeah. Yeah, we want to know all about their private lives for some reason.
Yeah.
But that's not the same thing. It's not...
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's led to a lot of the stars of the 30s, 40s, even 50s being undervalued because of that very quality.
Mm-hmm.
John Wayne, perfect example.
Yes.
Magnificent
yes.
actor. A magnificent actor. And yet, because he had this look and this persona and he had that voice, everybody just thought, oh, he's just being John Wayne. Cary Grant. Oh, he's just being Cary Grant. That's just the way he is. You know.
I think, and he's a really,
he's not,
yeah,
you know?
It's a really good observation, and that the undervaluing of what those people brought, and the high valuing today of wow, look at that person's range,
yeah.
right? And I can sometimes marvel at actors' range,
well, sure,
as much as anybody else, and I also feel as though range is oftentimes aided and abetted by all sorts of. The galaxy around that star.
Yeah.
The makeup, the lighting, the speech, the perhaps even CGI and so on and so forth. That's enhancing that range and that chameleon status. But you can't do that with personality stars, can
sure.
you?
No.
I mean, there's no CGI around John Wayne. You know, that makes
exactly,
that gives him
yeah.
his John Wayne-ness.
Yeah. And yeah, and I'm not by any means saying that acting was better then than it is now. I don't believe that's the case. Lots of great actors now. Lots of them.
Yes.
It's just different.
It's
just
different,
a different
right. It's not a question
thing.
Of better.
No.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, you got Cagney, and he talked that way and he looked that way, and there's nothing you could do about it. That's mm-hmm. the way. That's Cagney. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the few actors of that time that I would say you could catapult into today's style is Paul Muni, because that's what Paul Muni was always doing.
Yes.
Was putting on the makeup, always being a chameleon, changing himself, you know.
I was thinking Paul Muni before you said Paul Muni. And actually, interesting that Paul Muni is not that well remembered.
No, not at all.
And interesting that I'm not sure that Paul Muni has, not only is not that well remembered, but has that high a status among film historians.
No.
And it's interesting because, you know, people might say, oh, you know, he might be undervalued for the very reason that certain people today are, dare I say, perhaps overvalued relative to, you know, people's place in history or. So yes, it's interesting that, you know, Paul Muni comes up as an example, and yet he's certainly not remembered as fondly as.
That's because there's nothing
as
you could,
James Cagney or Gene Harlow.
You
or,
can't get a handle on Muni.
Right. Who was Paul Muni?
Yeah, if you were doing an impression, you know, if you were in 1935 and you were doing a stand-up act and you were doing impressions of the stars, you wouldn't do Paul Muni because there is no impression of him.
Well, and you know what? The whole idea of personalities coming through also even, I think, extends to beloved character actors
from
the 30s. Even though maybe they had a chance to express greater range, but I'm thinking of great people like Beulah Bondi and Thomas Mitchell and Claude Rains. I mean, these fantastic actors who were rarely at the stars.
Sure.
But Beulah Bondi being an example where she could play, you know, the most warm-hearted mother and the most cold-hearted something else, and yet still it was like, there's Beulah Bondi.
I mean, absolutely. And also, I was talking with Jordan Young, who's a character actor expert on this podcast, and I think we talked about this very subject, which is even the concept of the character actor means exactly the opposite today than it did then.
Mm.
Which, you know, you'll hear, let's say, Dustin Hoffman mm-hmm. call himself a character actor.
Yes.
What he means is that every time he does a movie, he tries to be somebody completely different. But Frank McHugh or Alan Jenkins or Franklin Pangborn didn't try to be different at all. They were hired to be Frank McHugh and Alan Jenkins and Franklin Pangborn. And when they walked on, or Billy Gilbert or mm-hmm. whoever, and they walked onto the screen, you knew exactly who they were.
Yep.
They got their laugh. They left. And it's a completely different thing now.
Yeah, well, they were types, right?
Yeah.
And so, and the dirty word today is typecasting, right? It's the very thing that many actors try to avoid. And I wonder if the Franklin Pangborns of this world were, you know, incredibly frustrated.
But I bet some were.
It can be very satisfying as an audience, right? To say, oh, here comes this beloved actor and I know exactly what I'm going to get from this actor. And I'm also wondering, you know, under the contract system of, you know, with Warner Brothers and elsewhere at the time, if it's a little bit like what, roughly like the experience of being, say, in a long-run series today, where your character names are different and the stories and settings are different, but the character itself might be extremely consistent. And how different is that from being in a sitcom for 8 years or whatever?
Yeah, a lot of those guys would go from set to set even on the same day.
Right.
Just go to different movies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're Lee Tracy, you go do a wisecrack in this movie, and then you go, you're a wisecracking reporter in that one. And
exactly.
You're a wisecracking lawyer in this one. So it's a completely different thing. Now, this will make a smooth segue, and I can do it two ways. I can bring it back to Karen Morley in this way.
You're good, Frank.
She won. Wheels for the wheels.
Don't lose those loose threads, yeah.
I always circle back. One time, Karen asked me who my favorite female stars were.
Hmm.
And I said, well, you, of course, Karen, because that's the correct answer. But then I said, but beyond you, my favorites are Myrna Loy, and she's nodded.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. And I said, and Joan Blondell.
Did you really say that?
Yeah.
Wow.
And Karen said, men.
She, yeah, I mean, I learned that about her too. She can be rather obtuse in her response.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I adore Joan Blondell. And, so I love your book on her. And so let's talk about her. She was a very different type than Dressler. She was never a huge star.
Right.
She was always a perfectly successful, okay star.
Yeah.
But, in the 30s, she has a lot of leading roles,
mm-hmm.
more supporting roles, and then after that, it's almost entirely
supporting roles.
Yeah.
Well, when I was starting to sort of take apart her career and look at it in detail, I realized that her widespread reputation was that she was a great supporting character actress. And as you said, in the 30s, she was actually a headliner, but she would be either support very early in her career in like pre-code films. She was supporting Barbara Stanwyck and even folks like Helen Twelvetrees and so forth as the second female. She would support Ruby Keeler and, but by the late 30s and into the early 40s, she was actually starring in films as the female lead, sometimes often opposite her husband, Dick Powell and so forth. But they weren't necessarily, you know, the big movies of the age. So when she was starring, they were sometimes in B pictures.
Yeah.
But then she took some time off right around just after World War II. And when she came back, she was in supporting roles, and that's where she stayed for the rest of her career. But, I mean, shall I tell you how I came to write that book?
I wish you would.
Okay. Well, I was interviewed for a documentary that was being done about Hollywood scandals. And I was asked to talk about the subject that I was working on at the time, which was the director Edmund Goulding, who had gotten into trouble through his wild parties and so forth that had become Hollywood legend of a sort.
If only you'd written a book about him.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Yeah. and I knew that the producer of this documentary was Norman Powell. Now, Norman Powell was the son of Dick Powell and Joan Blondell.
Wow.
And this was about, let's see, I want to say it was maybe 2002 or 2003 when we did this documentary. And then at the end of the, we had a wonderful time. It was very fun. And at the end of the day, Norman said, well, maybe, because the Goulding book hadn't been finished yet, but he said, maybe you should write a biography of my mother. And I knew his mother was Joan Blondell, and I had loved Joan Blondell. I watched Here Come the Brides as a kid, right? And that's how I worked backwards with her, just like with Dressler. You learn about her late career, and then you find out about her early career.
I did that with everybody.
Yeah, you did the same thing. Yeah, there you go. So when Norman said that, I put that little information away. I still had to finish the Goulding book, and then when it was over, I contacted Norman again. And I said, "Were you serious about that? Because I think I would like to very much." And he said, "Yes, I was serious, and let me talk to my sister and make sure she's okay with it." And I thought I liked that answer. I mean, that was respectful and honest, and yes, you absolutely should clear this with your sister. And he did. And she was okay with it, and we proceeded to write that book. And what made it special was the cooperation and generosity of her family, both her kids and her grandkids, and actually daughters-in-law and so forth, who, you know, freely shared photos and letters and family lore and all sorts of stuff that I think give the book a lot of personal touch. That, you know, would otherwise I would have been limited to clippings and so forth. It was the love of Blondell that sort of propelled me forward with that book, and plus Norman's cooperation and Ellen's, her daughter.
Yeah, I would say as somebody who's researched these books myself, Blondell's must have been easier than Marie Dressler in that. You can get to the Warner Brothers archives, but you can't get to the MGM archives, or at least most people can't.
Yes, actually, the Warner Brothers archives were great for Blondell.
Oh, sure.
Where she spent her early film career, and I love the Warner Brothers archives anyway, right?
Me too. I could live there.
Oh, they're fantastic. And, you know, I just gave them a laundry list of her films, and they just pulled the files, and there were, you know, great production notes and so forth. And it was also just great, not just necessarily looking for quotes and whatnot, but just for getting a chronology.
Yeah.
Like, okay, from this date to that date, she was working on this film with Glenda Farrell, and then from this date to that date, she was doing something with Cagney, and, you know, you could really sort of get a sense of her work schedule and how exhausting
it was. And also relative salaries and everything.
And yes, actually salaries, and also when she went on suspension, because Jack Warner got mad at her because she dared to ask for better roles or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So you could, yeah, that's the beauty of the Warner Brothers archives. You really can piece together the details of these contract careers.
I always hoped that my Lost Films book would have sold enough that I could have done another volume.
Mm. I know what you're going to say. Convention
well,
City.
Absolutely. That's one of the most, That's one of the saddest losses of film
Absolutely.
History, I think.
I was just talking to Mark Vieira a couple of days ago, who was on your program.
Yeah.
And we were talking about, you know, we were grieving Convention City.
Yeah.
And we both thought that maybe some, you know, we live in hope, right? That some print, some viewable print's going to show up because of the nature of how that film was distributed to conventions, you
yeah.
know, around the country. And that somebody kept a print, but...
Now, what's the story that you were told about why it's lost?
My recollection... Let's see. Yeah, as I recall, first of all, it's filled with a bunch of double entendres and, you know, dirty jokes about bodily functions and so forth. And it also apparently shows women in rather... you know, women's bodies are outlined in the film in such a way that was not okay after the code. It was obviously a pre-code film.
Sure.
And that Warner Brothers received all these multiple requests through the years, through the 30s at least, or at least a few years after it came out, that to show the film, that people wanted to see the film at largely all-male conventions, right? Because it's all about going crazy
sure.
when you're out of town and the wife's not watching and so forth. And so it was, you know, this entertainment at these different conventions. And Warner Brothers, in the era of the code, simply got embarrassed by it. You know, it's this dirty little movie that people are still liking, but we can't, even though it's making us money, our reputation is at stake or whatnot. And that Jack Warner said, burn it.
Yeah.
That's the story I
heard. That's what I've heard too. And I just can't believe it.
Really?
No.
Let's hear a counter theory. I like that.
Well, no, I don't have another theory. I just can't believe that one.
Uh-huh.
That's all I've ever been told. And I just can't believe that Warner would burn an asset. It just doesn't make any
yeah.
sense to me.
Yeah.
Put it away. Take it out of distribution.
Right.
Okay. But, you know, it's like that, that story about four devils, that the star of which, whose name has just gone right out of my head, not Janet Gaynor, but the other female star. The story is that she got the printout of the Fox archive because she wanted to see it years later, watched it, didn't like it, threw the print into the ocean. Mm-hmm. Now everybody tells this story as though
it's fact.
This could happen.
Yeah.
How in the world could that happen?
yeah.
How in the world could that yeah. happen? And so.
Well, you know.
Yeah. burning the thing, it just never made any sense to me.
Well, I guess, you know, we could deal with what we know and what we don't know, right?
Sure.
We know that it has not been seen, or there's been no, you know, widely publicized viewing. It's like, you know, the Loch Ness Monster or
yeah.
Bigfoot or whatever. It's like, if it's out there, it's highly elusive and, you know, people can, I haven't even actually ever heard that anybody's claimed to have seen it
no.
in our lifetime. So,
nor have I.
It's truly lost, but I think your point's well taken. And I wonder, like, well, it was an asset. So where is it? I mean, is there another story? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, Warner's, God knows, put out many pre-code films with lots of racy scenes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Lots of racy situations and semi-nudity and sometimes actual nudity. And I mean, just look at Blondell and Stanwyck and Night Nurse.
Absolutely.
They're in their underwear.
Right.
30% of that movie or more.
Well, the script to Convention City or a draft of the script does survive.
Yeah.
And it does strike me, I mean, you know, trying to visualize it as, you know, on screen, it does strike me as pretty, puerile. I mean, that's not the right word, because that sounds more negative than I mean it to, but it isn't just sexy. It's also, there are double entendres about bathroom habits and, you know, elimination and stuff like this. And, you know, for all the pre-code raciness, that's something that I don't really see as a very common theme. You know, sex, yes, drugs, yes, whatever, but.
Yeah. Well.
But it's there in Convention City in the script. So yeah. I don't know. It's a ongoing mystery.
One of the great Blondell scene, speaking of pre-code, is in Other Men's Women, another Wellman film. When
yes, that's right.
She's a waitress at a railroad stop. She's at a little cafe waitress. And a guy walks in. She says, "Well, you have." And he says, "I want a slice of you on toast." And she says, "No way, I'm APO. And he says, "What's that?" "Ain't putting out."
"Ain't putting out." Yeah.
Now that strikes me as beyond pre-code for some reason. That's just. That's really hitting the nail on the head. So.
It's great.
But.
Yeah. And by the way, I saw Wings. Bill Wellman's son presented Wings at a screening in San Francisco recently, and I saw it, and it was thrilling. It was
the restoration is great.
Yeah, it looked great.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw it a couple of times when they first showed it.
And he called it the Star Wars of its era.
Yes.
To emphasize it.
Yes, its
huge impact.
He always does. Yes.
Yeah, it does. Okay.
It's magnificent. But
yeah.
I'm trying to think. Wellman worked with Blondell just in those two films, right?
I think so.
Oh, Public Enemy. She's in Public Enemy.
Right. I mean, she's a very small role in that, but she is in it. Yeah.
Apparently a bigger role in the original film, because there are stills of her with Edward Wood in other scenes. So apparently there was more going on.
It really looks like she was cut. That wasn't intended to have a role that small. So, Frank, I'm going to ask you a Blondell question.
Since you're
such a big fan, do you have a favorite Blondell performance?
Possibly my favorite Blondell film, this is a cliche, but it's Gold Diggers of 1933, I would guess. I mean, obviously, the My Forgotten Man number is an iconic Blondell moment.
Mm-hmm.
But just the whole performance, And, it's, cheap and vulgar.
Cheap and vulgar. Cheap. Yeah. And, I like her. I love her equally in Footlight Parade.
Yeah.
And, not only is she with Cagney and they had such a fantastic screen chemistry, but it's a musical. So you've got the double bonus there, although she wasn't in musical numbers in that. But the theme in Footlight Parade of this unrequited love for Cagney, she plays that so well.
She does.
And then at the very end, there's the satisfying finale.
But you know what? Claire, my wife, for listeners who don't know, and how could you not? Because everybody who listens knows me personally. But Claire and I were watching The Office Wife the other night, and that's her first screen role, isn't it? Or pretty darn close.
She did Sinner's Holiday and she did The Office Wife. I believe the first one that was actually filmed was Sinner's Holiday, but Office Wife was the first to be released.
Ah.
So and I'd have to double check my book because there's a slight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she's terrific in that. I mean, she pops right off the screen in that thing.
Yeah.
And of course, to keep with the pre-code theme, there's not a scene in that film that she's not getting dressed or taking a bath they clearly took one look at Blondell and said, here's what we do with her.
But she is one of these people whose screen presence and screen effectiveness was apparent from her first appearance.
Yeah.
I mean, she obviously grew as an actress and matured as an actress, but the essential Blondell charisma was there from the very, very beginning.
Yeah, it's funny. We were talking earlier about Harlow and how funny she was in Dinner at Eight. But she didn't start out good, not by a long shot. You look at her in Hell's Angels.
Right.
And this is a stilted performance. And even in Public Enemy, Harlow is passable, but mm-hmm. not terrific. She had a curve.
Yeah, yeah.
And she definitely got to the top of that curve, and it was great. But Blondell, no. Day
from
one,
the,
she's...
From the starting gate, absolutely.
Yeah. And just about anything. I recently watched Havana Wives.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the other one? There's another one on that disc, because my wife got that for Christmas.
Oh, the Forbidden Hollywood?
Yeah. No, this is just a double. It's from the Turner Archives.
Mm.
So it's... anyway, but it was two Blondells. And anything pre-code with Blondell is going to be good.
Yeah.
The same way with any pre-code film with Warren Williams is going to be good. Not that I necessarily think Warren Williams is the greatest actor in the world, but 100% of his films are great. It's just that this is the way it is. If he's in it, it's a good movie. That's just the way
I've never heard that about. Now you make me want to see more Warren Williams. I haven't looked at him that way. Yeah.
There's certain people I can quantify in various ways. Do you know the director Roland Brown?
I know the name. I couldn't give you.
He only made three features, and all three of them are masterpieces, which leads me to call him the greatest single director who ever lived.
There you go.
Because he made nothing but good movies.
Mm-hmm.
He only made three, but
they're all great. I have to ask what they are.
Blood Money.
Uh-huh.
With Judith Anderson as a moll, and George Bancroft as a gangster. And then Hell's Highway with Richard Dix as in the chain gang,
mm-hmm.
which is terrific. And the third one, I've just forgotten.
You know what? I will walk a country mile to see Judith Anderson in anything.
Yeah, to see her.
I love Judith Anderson.
Yeah.
And the idea of her as a gun moll is pretty enticing because I'm thinking of her later performances in Laura and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and
the
Furies.
But what's even greater in Blood Money is Frances D.
Mm.
And this is 1932, so it's a very young, gorgeous Frances D. who plays a character unlike anything anybody else has ever played in that period. She's this S&M-loving, nymphomaniac, crazed,
oh my
thrill-seeking.
Goodness.
And she's having a scene with somebody, and I can't remember the dialogue exactly, but he says, you know, if, oh shoot, how does it go? He says, you know, somebody ought to give you a good beating, and I bet you'd like it. And she says, you think you're kidding. There's that kind of stuff. So, but, yeah. Blood Money, I give my highest five-star recommendation.
Instantly going on my must-see list.
It's hard to find. Never been on video for some reason. I don't know why.
Does it show up on Turner? Can I just watch for the title?
I don't know that it ever has.
Huh.
Hell's Highway has shown up on Turner before.
Yeah.
But what do you like best about Blondell? I mean, which of her...
Golly.
I've read other interviews that you've done... because I want to make sure I didn't ask the same questions, of course. But I always got the feeling that you were a little bit more interested in Blondell from the later time than from the earlier time.
I do love Blondell in the 30s, absolutely. And actually, in terms of earlier performances, I'm quite taken by her in Blonde Crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's such a fast, funny movie with Cagney. And I will watch anything that she does with Cagney.
Sure.
Because I think that's one of the great screen teams. And it doesn't get a lot of press. You know, it's certainly not Powell and Loy, for example. But they really did work together so beautifully.
Absolutely.
And they adored each other privately. So that translated. As I understand, Powell and Loy did. Were great buddies. But I do like the later, like from the late 40s on, Blondell. I like the kind of world-weary quality that she brought to her later performances. Lover in Nightmare Alley. And in the 50s, she's remarkably good in roles that sometimes are a bit underwritten, like The Girl Who Has Everything with Jane Mansfield.
Yeah.
And then I love her at the very end of her career in Opening Night, the John Cassavetes film,
sure.
where she plays a writer who's kind of fed up with Jenna Rollins, you know, screwing with her script, and as Jenna Rollins, you know, as the yeah. unstable actress. So I do like the kind of depth or life experience that she brings to her later performances as well. But yeah, I love her through and through.
Yeah, like you, I first saw her in Here Come the Brides, where I also learned the bluest skies you've ever seen are in Seattle.
That's right. You know, I think there's some Seattleites who might take issue with
possibly,
that.
Possibly, yeah. But it occurs to me that that was the case with almost everybody. Because when I was watching TV as a child, when you think of who was in those series, mm-hmm. you know, Walter Brennan and,
it's
you know,
true.
All these people that you just got to know as middle-aged or older mm-hmm. people, Andy Devine, you know,
Barbara
Stanwyck, Ward Bond.
For that matter, yeah.
All these people that you just thought, meh. And then suddenly you realize that they all were these remarkable people. But, yeah, Blondell, I'm sure that was my first look at her.
And, you know, I think it speaks to age and the passing of time and whatnot. But when I was writing that book and people were saying, who is Joan Blondell? My first reference that was most likely to get a reaction was Here Come the Brides, which is also interesting because that series only lasted for 2 years.
Yeah.
It was never a giant ratings boom, and it's available on DVD, but I don't, and I think it's on one of those station, TV Land or one of those.
I've never seen it come up, but it
national.
Might be. Yeah.
It's not exactly, you know, it's not brought back and revived and remembered the
sure.
way some of those others from that era are. And yet, there a lot of folks, you know, about our age do remember her as Lottie the saloon keeper.
Yeah.
So, which I think also says something about her qualities as a performer that, you know, she made a very big impression.
Yeah.
In a role that, you know, could have been easily forgotten.
So that's where we'll stop, and we're about to start talking about the director Edmund Goulding, and then we'll start talking Roadshow in part two of my interview with Matthew Kennedy, which is already up and running, so download it at your leisure. Hope you enjoy it. Want to remind you that my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beaugest, is available from my website, thecommentarytrack.com, or if you choose, you can order it through Amazon. And if you're from a foreign country, you'll have to order it through Amazon because I offer free shipping, but in the U.S. only. And I guess you could always just contact me and we could figure out what the shipping is, but I'd rather not go through all that work. Would you? Come on. Just go through Amazon and get it. But otherwise, it's just as easy to order it directly through me. Just go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, go to the videos page, and there it is, Bob's Your Uncle. I want to thank my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, for being my announcer, James Hutchins for designing my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and franktompson.tv, Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my wonderful theme music fore and aft, and I want to thank you, the listeners who have told other people about this show, and I want to thank everybody who's gone to iTunes and left a comment. And I must say, there aren't that many of you to thank about that. But I hope there will be more. Come on, let me play on your guilt. That's the only way we can spread the word about this thing, through social media, through Facebook, through Twitter, and then going and leaving a nice review and a 5-star rating on iTunes. It would really help bring other people to the show. And believe me, I need to bring other people to the show. We have a very small listenership. A great listenership. I love each and every one, and I respect each and every one of you and your wonderful taste in podcasts. But we happy few, there are just not many. So I hope that you will all tell a friend, tell 5 friends, get them to tell 5 friends, and then soon this podcast will be the most popular in the history of podcasts, and I will become a megalomaniac, as I have always meant to be. So, I'll see you next time, and in the meantime, don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.